Doesn't that computer know who you
are? Don't they have any idea?
Bow down to the Tech Talk host.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Behold the glory that is me.
A little while ago, I was installing some software, and I ran across this exact same.
I find you pompous, judgmental, and completely self-absorbed. Would you be my friend?
Onto a Windows Vista machine.
You would think.
You'd think there'd be no problem.
How could there be a problem with that?
I'd say in a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Directory permissions with config.msi directory, blah, 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 blah. This is Tech Talk. Good morning. This is Tech Talk on WRLR 88.3 FM. Michael, Tech Talk Caster with you this morning. Oh, man. Oh, great. I'm excited about today's show. I'm excited. I'm easily excitable, but this is really going to be a great show. Not only do we have our usual monkey business, and Jay Garman's going to be on with us in just a few minutes to answer last week's geek trivia question. Cool sights of the week, of course, coming up at the end of the show. I promise a good podcast only song of the week, and actually it's going to be good enough to play on air live here for those that are listening on their dials at 98.3 FM. But also too, in just a little bit, we're going to have James Miller, author of Singularity Rising. He's going to come on and talk to us about the coming robopocalypse. Well, okay, it's not a robopocalypse. This is going to be the ultra AI and the takeover of ultra intelligent artificial intelligence in the world. And we're going to talk about that. And let me tell you, it is a fascinating, fascinating subject. This is a fantastic book. I was so excited to find out that I was going to be able to get him on air with us today. Stay tuned. That's all I can tell you is just don't move that dial. Don't touch it. We're going to have a great time this morning. So speaking of having great times this morning, changes in the world, all this good stuff. There's been a lot of things that happened this week, of course, surrounding CES, the Consumer Electronics Show. Yours truly is not there, so I'm not going to speak a lot about what's going on there. There's so much information out and available of the things that are being touched on. It really seems, the only thing that I will mention is it really seems, and I'd been expecting this to happen for some time, so I'm excited to find out that it is truly seeming to occur now, that there's a lot of automobile automation coming out of the show. And that's just something. Now, if you're like me, you know, if you commute to work every day, or if you don't, you know, I don't commute to work every day. I'm fortunate enough to work from my home. I'm able, though, I have to take long trips occasionally in my car. I rely on the paltry automobile automation that I have currently, which lets me connect my cell phone up to the speakers in the car. That's just a bare notch of capability and capacity, but I rely on it so much. I have my GPS that runs through my phone. My music runs through my phone. I listen to a tremendous amount of spoken word broadcasting, podcasts, and things like that. You know, like the Tech Talk Show, although I don't listen to myself. But not ever, but occasionally, usually I'm not listening to myself. Don't get the impression that I'm driving around, you know, like the old Steve Martin bit, you know, Mike, you're awesome. Mike, you are great. You know, I have that going on in the background all the time. But I do listen to a lot of that. And when that fails on me, when I'm driving, especially a long distance, and that fails on me, I get just spitting, cussing mad at my phone, at the car, at whoever developed Bluetooth in general. I'm mad at everybody. And so the advent of more automation is both, you know, ironically enthralling to me, but also frightening, because as it becomes more prevalent, my reliance on it, I know, is going to grow. When I get that next car, whenever that may be, and it's got built-in connectivity and Android operating system as its base and all this other great stuff, I'm going to be relying on that, and I'm going to want it to work and just really just work every time I step in. So it'll be very interesting to see what comes out of CES as it regards to automation in automotive areas and the number of things that can and will be done and what will be successful, what's going to stand the test of time, what's going to be stable enough that people are not going to want to just just run that thing into a light pole, because that's how I feel a lot of times. So we'll see how that shapes up in the next few weeks. One thing, you know, there's a couple of things I want to touch on before we give Jay a call. I'm going to give Jay a call fairly early this morning so we can move into the interview fairly early as well. But there's a couple of things I really wanted to touch on. If you haven't heard about it yet, this is pretty cool. Is if you're still buying your music as opposed to streaming it only, relying on Spotify and Pandora and Slacker and Songza and all these others, as I typically do, if you're still buying them, this is going to mean a lot to you, is that now when you buy a CD, like an actual hard CD, like the round things, remember those that you could stick into a radio? Yeah, those. If you buy one of those, Amazon now is offering AutoRip. And AutoRip automatically makes those CDs available to you through the cloud and also to download. They are DRM free. You can do what you want with them. You can copy them onto your own CDs. You can do whatever you want to do it with it. And not only that, but those ripped CDs are at a pretty decent bid rate. They're at 256 kbps. Now, that's not excessively high. I know that our good friend Michael Miller up in Minneapolis there would say, you know, for a true audiophile, that's, you know, just still, you're still dealing with MP3s. But for the typical process of burning a CD that we go through, that's about where I go at when I want a good copy, is around 256k. If I don't care that much, I just want something that'll fit in a lot of them onto my CD or my flash drive, you go down as low as 128k a lot of times. So this is very interesting. Now, this has been an idea that's been around for a long time. In fact, in the early 90s, there was a gentleman who he created, I think it was called mp3.com, in fact, was the name of his website. And he had come out with this idea, got sued out of existence almost immediately, came back in 2005 again with the same idea, got, I think it was Universal Music was on board with the concept and the idea of it. Everybody else said, forget you, we're not doing it. And again, it failed. Now, though, you've got Jeff Bezos, you've got Amazon behind it, and it seems like it's really, really happening. And not only that, I believe that they're allowing you to, yeah, play this through any cloud player. It's doing everything that should have been possible from the moment music went digital, and it's finally happening. So that's a pretty cool thing. I would go check it out. If you're one of these people that buys music now, we've had this discussion on air before. I am not one of those people anymore. I just don't buy a lot of music. I buy things that I need. I buy things that I need to be legal here on the station too. But for my personal listening pleasure, the way that I find music and the way that I listen to music, 98% of the time is not through something that is owned by me and is in a hard copy of any sort. It's through streaming, as I said, through all those different streaming services. On a completely different note here, have you gotten one of those invites to add your birth date to somebody's My Birthday calendar on Facebook and wondered, what is this thing? Is this a scam? And you send emails and you send Facebook notes to your friends saying, hey, your Facebook account got hacked and all that. You know what? It turns out these are actual legitimate apps. They're not really malware. You want to be careful with anything like anything really that you put on to your Facebook account or into your computer at all. But I got a lot of notes this last week about this and people wondering about it and sending me emails. You say, hey, can Tech Talk discuss this? So what this application is, I did a little bit of research. What this application is, it is a legitimate app. Yes, it's ad-driven. Yes, they're trying to make some money off of it by promoting it and putting it through. Do you need it? Absolutely not. It's just a whole separate sideline to Facebook's already pretty darn good birthday app that they have inclusive in the application, which is a lot more secure than this third-party one. Now, the benefit to this one, supposedly, going by their website information and so on, is that there's people that don't put their Facebook birthday dates on Facebook. They don't want to be bothered by that by everybody, but they are willing to allow a certain subset of individuals know their birthday and have their birthday be managed through one of these apps. You know, I take that with a grain of salt. My personal belief on this is that it's not a useful application. I would not recommend you installing it, but at least you can kind of rest a little bit easier if you have installed the application that it's not going to have a problem. Now, Snopes has got a great little article on it. They've cleared the app of any wrongdoing. If you go to Snopes and just look for birthday, Facebook birthday, that kind of thing, you'll find it there, and you'll see what that's all about. So I hope that answered questions for people, as I said, that were sending me that information. I've got some bad news for you, though, and I'm going to talk about this, I'm sure, with Jay, and I'm going to give Jay a call right now. The bad news has to do with the Death Star and the whether or not America is going to create a Death Star in our lifetime. There had been an actual poll online that you can do.
Hello.
Oh, good morning, Mr. Garmin. How you doing, sir?
Pretty good. About yourself, Chief?
Not bad. Not bad. Although I'm bummed out. I was just talking to people and sharing my depression now that I have official word from the U.S. government that we are not going to create our own Death Star.
Well, you know, I consider that a victory for responsible government, especially considering that the previous two Death Stars that we know of did not even reach operational status for more than 30 days before they were destroyed by enemy forces. So clearly, that's a boondoggle of the highest order.
Hey, if we wanted responsible government, just look at the last 4 or 5 elections or so. We clearly don't want responsible government. and now that huge investment I made in white plastic suits, you know, what am I going to do with that?
Whoa, no one said we aren't building Star Destroyers. We said we are building Death Stars. Those are two totally separate issues. Besides, you also got to consider the fact that it's entirely possible that Cylons could come in white.
Oh, yeah. You know, I hadn't considered that. That's true. There could be maybe an Uber class of Cylon that is designed out of white.
If anyone's going to design the next real, like, android that walks around the house, it's going to be Apple, and the first generation of every Apple product always comes in white.
Good point. All right. I won't dump them yet. I'll hold on to the investment and and parlay that. Maybe in fact what I'll do is I'll get a whole bunch of those little black Apple stickers, and then I'll be prepared to put those on the lapels when this starts to come to fruition.
Also bear in mind, if the next couple of Apple technology releases disappoint as much as some of the fanboys that didn't like the last few releases, the Genius Bar guys are gonna need body armor.
Good point. That's an even better argument for white plastic suits for the Apple guys. Yeah, absolutely. Especially if they try another rendition of Apple Maps and it comes out about as well as this last one did. I would not want to. Would not want to be there with those guys.
Well, you know, we talked about wanting to set up some sort of blood drive for people in line. There may be bloodletting whether we're there or not.
Exactly. Yeah, you just need the buckets to collect it. Really, is all that you need at that point. I was impressed though with the humor that was shown. And it was on spot humor too that was shown by the response from the government. I don't have the article up in front of me, so I don't know who it was that actually responded to it. But it started off with you know, these are not the results of the poll you were looking for, and there was a lot of really apropos, you know, in reference stuff to the Star Wars series, and it just did a well done job. I thought of making it clear, but also being fun with it.
Yeah, it's nice to know every once in a while that the people that work in these offices are human. They aren't just your political robots, which would actually be kind of funny given the context, that sort of just spout out, you know, PR speak like they actually are human beings. And I think the guy who wrote it, his name is Paul Shawcross, who I've never heard of before, but gold star for you, Chief, for basically, for those, I don't know how much of the background you did before the call, but basically... WhiteHouse.gov lets you always do these petitions and polls for what you'd like the government to work on. They're non-binding, but they're sort of a great feedback mechanism. And somebody said, wrote in very serious terms, the government should build a Death Star. And, of course, this being the Internet, it got enough votes to, like, make it into the top five or something,
yeah,
which required a response. And they wrote this response about, hold up, first off, it would cost, like, $850 quadrillion, which... I've done some of these calculations on a lark in some of my blog life in the past, and that's really like what it's going to take. Like people like Forbes have done this before. It's like it's ungodly expensive to consider doing it,
yeah,
which is a ballpark estimate. But then they went on to say, and by the way, history has proven that a one-man fighter craft can take this thing out. Are you kidding me?
Exactly. Yeah, there's some major design flaws that need to be addressed before we would even consider undertaking some of this. Yeah, I guess, as you say, he showed he was human, but the thing that just really put me in awe was so many times you see stuff like this come out and the tone is just a little off, or there's some things where it's clear they just don't get it and they miss the mark and the humor falls flat and it just winds up becoming sort of, you know, a mockery of the of the story and of the things that are happening. And that didn't happen here. They got it all right. I don't even know what to say. It was astonishing to me.
Well, they must have tracked down one of the nerds in the White House and had them help, because they clearly got it. Like these were not references they pulled off Wikipedia from an intern in like 5 minutes. Like, someone has watched the films and is at least moderately steeped in the lore to really get this.
Exactly. Yeah, it was clear that they didn't just try to cross-reference, that it was somebody who understood it, who had lived it and loved it and saw it in the response that they wanted to make. So it's good stuff. Yeah, people can go and find that at WhiteHouse.gov. There's places there where you can put petitions up for anything, and it supposedly, theoretically, if it gets beyond a certain level of votes, thumbs up from other people that want a response, the White House is compelled by their new focus on transparency to respond to you. That has not been happening as they had declared. In fact, they kept changing the goalposts for how many people needed to respond. But maybe they're reconsidering and going back and kind of trying to hit some of these. They did give us a great beer recipe, though.
I had not read that one, but I will take your word for that.
They did, yes. People wanted to know apparently there's beer that's made at the White House, and people wanted that recipe, and enough people voted for it that they responded and gave them the recipe. So they did. They were transparent about the hops and all the other business. Jay, we got to move things along fairly quickly. It's actually speaking about robots and the robopocalypse and things like that. I'm going to have James Miller of Singularity Rising on in just a couple of minutes here. So I hate to cut you short, but I need to get into that and find out what I can do to protect myself from the coming singularity.
Especially since I don't know any good ways to generate electromagnetic pulses short of detonated small nuclear weapons. So please take good notes.
Absolutely. I'm recording it for posterity, assuming that AI has not reached a point where they can already scramble our signals. We'll have a record of this that'll be available for at least some period of time pre-singularity.
Oh, please. This is a Skype call. It's being recorded 9 ways to Sunday by people not including you. This is in an archive somewhere already being mined for advertising data. Yeah. Don't kid yourself.
Yep, this is true. This is true. So we're well past the New Year's now, but I do recall our last question had to do with there is actually a country out there that sadly hasn't gotten to experience New Year's. Where was this and why? How did that happen?
In 1994 or 1995, because we're talking about the crossover date here, the country of Kiribati did not have December 31st, or at least part of it didn't, because Kiribati is a series of islands that include the Gilberts and the Phoenix Islands and Hawaiian Islands are in the middle of the Pacific, right on the international date line. And part of the country was on one side of the date line, and part of the country was on the other. So literally, they had different days in the same country for a big chunk of a 24-hour period. So in 1994, they had a president elected who was going to, quote, solve the problem. And his solution was, on December 30th, they were going to move the ones on one side of the line to the other, like literally just put a little dent in the international date line, and two of the sets of islands would skip December 31st and go from December 30th to January 1st and line up with the other ones. So they've done that, so they're all on the same time zone now. They're on the same day, more than just time zone. They're all on the same day. So, but literally, the Line Islands and the Phoenix Islands in 1994 just skipped New Year's Eve.
They missed it. Everybody had all those that stockpile of fireworks and party hats and horn blowers and then nothing. And then the president comes out and says, "Sorry, we're done. We're done this year. No New Year's."
Well, they have bigger problems because this is one of the countries that may disappear due to rising sea levels.
Oh. Okay. Yeah, that could be a concern then for them in the coming decade here.
Yeah, they're like, in the next 75 years, we might not exist. if projections hold, we'll be underwater in the next 75 years. So, they literally have to have an evacuation plan for the country.
Wow, wow, man, that's not fun. But I guess you know it's kind of like living along the San Andreas or something, or at the top of a big hill overlooking the ocean, where you have to make that trade off and be understanding of the fact that, you know, it's not going to take a lot of change in the world that I cannot control around me to make this a really bad idea.
Yeah, well, I think the ones that take the cake on that, as long as we're stalling here, is people that live, like, in front of the volcanoes in Hawaii. Like, this is an active volcano. There is molten rock that goes by your neighborhood on a fairly regular basis.
Exactly. You might want to think about this. Exactly. So now, what was the name of the islands again? It was the
Kiribati.
The Kiribati.
And they just became a member of the UN in 1999, so they're a fairly young country in terms of international circles. But they're making some news despite their youth.
All right. I'm going to have to look them up. I never even heard of them. I am ashamed to say my knowledge of geography is just not good. And, yeah, I hadn't heard of them. I'm going to look those up. So what should we be thinking about for this coming week?
Well, the Boeing 787 Dreamliner has made all the wrong kind of technology news this week, with the oil leaks and the exploding batteries and electrical fires and that sort of thing. And it's going to get an FAA review. But what's interesting to me is that the technology in the Boeing 787 was predicted to be so advanced that a very particularly advanced other vehicle created by the United States government was going to use some of its tech. So, what was the intended government use for the 787's high-end technology that has since been canceled, thank goodness, because the government project was canceled, and we're lucky.
Okay.
But this clearly unreliable aircraft would not going to have its tech used somewhere else more important.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Interesting. I mean, immediately, of course, my thoughts turn to military, but I suspect there's more to it, as there always is with your trivia questions. Very, very interesting. And yeah, and hopefully they get some of those bugs worked out before they let more passengers on.
Well, you and I are old web guys, and we both know that the best place to test technology is in a production environment.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. That's the first thing you do. You set the server up and, let people on. that's the only way to really load test something. Well, Jay, I'm going to let you run. JayGarman.net, though, is where people can find out more about what's going on with Jay. And, we'll look forward to hearing the answer to that and perhaps having a little more time to chat again next week as well.
All right. Have fun with the robo-apocalypse, buddy.
I appreciate it. We'll do our best.
All right. Take care.
Take care. Thanks, Jay. Bye. Jay Garman. Go to jaygarman.net. Always great to hear from him. Okay, I'm not burning any more time here. We are well past when I wanted to bring on Jim Miller. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, very good. Very good. Thank you for joining us, Jim. I apologize. We're running just a little bit late here this morning. I don't want to cut into our time any more than I have to. I've started talking to people already about your book, about yourself. But could you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about Singularity Rising?
Sure. I'm an associate professor of economics at Smith College. And I've come to think that increases in human and artificial intelligences are going to define our economy for the next century. Now, the singularity is a theoretical period of time in which we'll either have machines that are a lot smarter than people, or we'll have significantly increased human intelligence. And I think there's a decent chance this could come, you know, in the next few decades. And there's so many ways we can increase human or get artificial intelligence, and there's such tremendous economic and military benefits to do so, that I think unless our civilization collapses, we're likely to experience a singularity.
We did bypass the fiscal cliff, so there's a better chance now that our society may not collapse, at least in the next couple years.
Yes.
Now this is a fascinating topic, and I know that the listeners out there, certainly my listeners would be aware of and probably have read a lot of the science fiction and a lot of the contemplation about the idea of an ultra AI. Charlie Strauss writes about a lot of this stuff. Of course, Werner Wing, who you quote and who is really kind of one of the top guys who started laying out that groundwork of what would a singularity look like and why we should be worried about it, has also written a number of fictional ideas of that. How close to the fiction do you think the reality is going to wind up being?
That's a tough question. I would say if we take, say, the Terminator view, where we'll be in a war with computers, I think the war part is possible, but I don't think there'll be some epic struggle. I think it would, if we did get in conflict with ultra-intelligent AIs, it would be more like the U.S. military declaring war on a tribe of chimpanzees. It would be very, very quick, and it wouldn't make for an interesting movie.
Yeah. it would start and be over before we even really woke up and understood what was happening. Now why is that? In a big part of what drives the concept of a singularity is kind of an extrapolation, and correct me certainly if I've misunderstood, but an extrapolation of Moore's law. And Moore's law, as we know in computers, is what drives the advancement of processor speed, drives the advancement of processor capacity and capability on this continuous series of this growth. Is that why you would expect it to be over so quickly, or why it will happen so surprisingly?
I think it's the latter. I mean, an implication of Moore's law is that the amount of computing power you can buy per dollar about doubles every year. So let's imagine that today we create a computer as smart as a typical human scientist. Mm-hmm. Well, 20 doublings is a million-fold increase. So that means in 20 years, this computer that today we can buy for say, $100,000, it's as smart as one scientist, could do the work of a million scientists in 20 years, and that's such an amazing increase. Now, to get the really rapid intelligence explosion, then we say, well, Moore's Law comes about because we have human engineers. What would happen if we had computing engineers, we had super smart AI engineers redesigning computer chips and redesigning themselves? Then we might not just get Moore's Law, we might get a doubling every hour.
Mm-hmm. And that makes a lot of sense, you know, for a moment. Is it, you know, we're already doing that to some degree. We're leveraging the technology that we create with this technology to make that process even easier. No one uses a drafting board anymore with blue pencils. You know, they're doing it on a computer with advanced CAD software and design software.
Oh yeah, that's absolutely right. And this process will go even faster once we've mastered nanotechnology, mm-hmm. where it's pretty easy to go from software to hardware. And if you had an AI that could do that, that could redesign very quickly its own processing chips and its own operating system, then you could quickly have it going from a little bit above human level intelligence to being basically a god from our point of view.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things about that is, you know, Moore's Law is always depicted as this straight line growth pattern of increase. But even from its very inception, it's been predicted that, oh, that's not, you know, the true picture, that it's going to flatten out and we'll just kind of all of a sudden realize, oh, we've reached pretty much where we're going to get to. Why don't you think that's going to happen? Why do you think it's going to continue on that straight line growth?
I'm not certain that it will continue. I imagine from what Intel is saying, at least for the next decade or so, it's guaranteed. But even if we don't get Moore's Law in its traditional sense, we know that the price of computing power almost certainly can go down a lot just because of our brains. I mean, our brains are still a lot more powerful than any computer, and we know that they can exist, and the raw material used to make them isn't very expensive. Mm-hmm. Now, our brain uses massive parallel processing rather than having any one fast computer, but that could be enough, too, to give us super intelligence. I mean, after all, that's what our brains use.
Mm-hmm.
So nature has proven that it's possible to get really cheap computing power.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think that's that's an interesting point as well. There's a part in your book where you compare relative intelligences and how they look, so that you can see how that growth pattern might look. And you start with an ant intelligence on the lower left, and you end with von Neumann on the right, and you're there in the middle somewhere, along with chimpanzees and so on. Very very modest of you, putting yourself pretty much right next to the chimp's level of intelligence. But you can see that the growth pattern for that is not as extreme as we would expect. But at that part in the book, too, you also talk about how the increase that Moore's Law predicts is essentially an increase in speed. And that as that increase in speed continues to go on, processing speed, that's where we've seen this increase in intelligence growth in computers. But I wonder if that's not truly accurate. It seems to me that there's more than just an increase in speed that's occurring in the difference between the processing power of an ant versus the processing power of a chimp. We have some really definite structural differences and other things that create intelligence outside of just processing speed.
No, you're right. I think processing speed sort of gives us a minimum increase we would expect. If a computer can run twice as fast, then it could do twice as much in the same amount of time. Mm-hmm. But you're right, you also can get changes in software and changes in architecture. We don't really have a general theory of intelligence yet, so we don't quite know why is it that humans are so much smarter than chimpanzees, or why was John von Neumann so much smarter than I am? Is it, was there some kind of overall neural efficiency, or did he have certain twists in neurons or whatever that I didn't have? But you're right, the possibility that people could say, hey, look, neuroscientists maybe a few decades from now, hey, look, this explains why some people are so much smarter than others, and then we can replicate that or put it into our software.
Yep.
And we could get even faster increases in intelligence than you would get just by extrapolating from Moore's Law.
Yeah, and that speaks to another little bit later part in your book, where you talk about some of the avenues and ways that we have that are available right now to making this occur. And one of them is emulating a human brain, but that may not be the best route then.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's in some ways emulation is we don't really understand how the human brain works, but we can examine it. We can look at its DNA. We can scan it in detail, so we can just directly copy it, and that almost certainly has to happen. It might be that we figure out a better way of doing it first. So it's sort of the equivalent of, if you can't fly, do you look at a bird and copy it, knowing it has to work if you get a good enough copy, or do you try to build something like an airplane?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the fact that the bird exists means you're going to figure out how to get something to fly eventually if you put enough effort into it.
Yep. Although, as you point out, the way that we actually choose to fly now has very little resemblance to a bird.
Yeah, we figured out much better ways, and that, that's an argument to say, well, evolution created our brains through this sort of random process. It's really unlikely evolution just happened to hit upon the most efficient formula for creating intelligence. So chances are, when we figure it out, we're going to come up with something much, much better, and that's both great and scary.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and that word at the end of your sentence there is a perfect segue into my next thought process. So we get there somehow by hook or by crook, and we have these ultra AIs that are incredibly intelligent. What does it mean to be an ultra AI to us? And then why is that something we should be afraid of?
Well, I would say intelligence is the ability to solve problems, and the ability to, you have a goal, and your intelligence is your ability to accomplish that goal. And something that's much smarter than us would be able to basically ignore us if it wanted to. And if that really smart thing decides they don't care about us, well, there's a limited amount of resources in the universe, and it would probably take the resources that we need to survive and use them for its own goals and leave us to die. In contrast, if it was friendly towards us, it could, create a utopia.
Mm-hmm.
We don't particularly care about species that are, much less intelligent than we are. We're quite willing to let most of the chimps in the world die, and it seems likely that an AI that had goals other than caring about humans would kill us, not out of malice or evil, but just out of indifference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a wonderful quote in the book. It says, for a huge set of potential goals, an AI would raise itself to be ultra intelligent and then kill all of us.
Yeah, no, that's what, in researching this book, that's what scares me the most, is that most possible objectives an AI would have would result in it killing us. I mean, if an AI wanted to be really good at chess for some reason, well, it would convert all of the molecules on Earth to chess, and that would mean there'd be nothing left for us. Mm-hmm. If it wanted to build certain things, well, generally the best way of building things ends up putting up lots and lots of pollution into the Earth. Now, we don't let our companies do it because we're not suicidal, but an AI wouldn't need to breathe or eat or drink, so it would just quickly poison the atmosphere and kill us, not because it hated us, just because it wanted to create all these widgets, and we couldn't stop it. So we really need an AI that's explicit goal is be friendly towards people, and if we don't get that, we're probably dead.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and and that's a good point too. One of the questions that I wrote down was how would you define friendly in this context? There's such a wide range of value for the word friendly, as in we started with just doesn't care enough to bother us, up to has some goals that are aligned with ours, so it wouldn't cause us harm, or even all the way to specifically tasked to protecting and looking out for our interests. Where do we want to be on that list?
Well, I don't know. I don't think anyone knows right now how to define friendliness, but I know we're going to have to do it in terms of mathematics. Now, we mentioned John von Neumann before. He was one of the world's greatest mathematicians. He also put a lot of work into coming up with mathematical theories of human preferences. It's used a lot in my area of economics. And I know there are people at the Singularity Institute right now that are trying to build on von Neumann's theories to create basically a math of friendliness, and their goal eventually is to put this into software. I don't know if they're going to succeed, though. This might not end up being possible.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, we have a pretty tough time reliably teaching any of those things to just humans who we fairly well understand the goals and objectives of.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Although there are some people who are clearly friendly, and there's probably something in our genetics that makes at least some people friendly, and if we could figure out what that is, mm-hmm. then maybe we could have a chance of transferring that to our software.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the stance of the Singularity Institute, and I want to hear more about that in just a second too, but it sounds like the stance of the Singularity Institute is that that morality, ethics, and compassion, these types of things are not only teachable, but they're also objective in some sense, that they can be quantified and as such then applied to the growth of an intelligence.
I'm not sure that's quite it. You might be right, but I think it's more that they need to have a chance of success. They need to be able to quantify all of this. They need to be able to capture in math what we value.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a general view, and there tend to be very sort of scientific-like people, that everything can be reduced to science and math. I'm not sure if they're certain that can happen, though, but it's just that we need to, and that should be the most important current project of our species,
mm-hmm.
is to figure out how to quantify friendliness and niceness before we have created these super intelligent AIs.
Yeah, and just so you know, my background is actually as a philosophy major, so I... These are the things that keep me up at night, you know, is how we do this. But yeah, so you mentioned though the Singularity Institute, and it sounds like some of their goal is to keep this from happening, keep an unfriendly AI from inhabiting the Earth at some point. Who is the Singularity Institute? Who makes them up, and what are they about?
Sure. Well, they were founded by someone who was a child prodigy, Eliezer Yudkowsky, and he got some funding from some high-tech people, and they've attracted some very bright people, and some of what they're doing is they're working on this math theory, and they're also promoting interest in friendly AI. And oddly, they're also trying to make humans more rational. They've created a website called LessWrong.com, in which any of your listeners could go now and learn how to become more rational in themselves. So the idea is there's a link between human rationality and AI rationality. And also the people who are going to end up coding these ultra AIs, they themselves should really understand what it means to be rational, so they can understand their own preferences and understand what it would mean for them, say, to care about other people.
Yep. Yep. Well, and that's a huge issue, of course, is we're attempting to, you know, work with defining the actions of rational beings when we ourselves at our core are not rational. And, you know, I know as an economist, you certainly have seen that in the fact that, you know, we are not rational beings in the way that we deal with our money and the way that we deal with our governments and all this, that there's this known irrationality factor that comes into how we operate. The LessWrong.com is a great place to look. I'm very interested in that aspect of things as well.
You're right. I mean, we need, if we're going to create something, a really powerful, like, super version of ourselves, we at least need to, you know, get our own behavior under control.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, well, yeah, and that's a good point. Now, we talked briefly about, you know, emulating the human brain as being one path to AI singularity. Were there some others that we haven't touched on yet?
Well, another path has been proposed by a futurist, Ray Kurzweil, and that's where we merge with machines. Right now, people already have machines in them. Like, we wear glasses, we have iPads attached to our, you know, to earbuds, people have pacemakers in their brains. And Kurzweil predicts that we're going to get more and more of these machines inside us, and some of them are going to directly help with cognition. And because of Moore's Law, these machines will keep getting faster and faster, so we can upgrade ourselves to superintelligence.
Yeah, that is fascinating. I you know, and of course, you know, every year there's something new that's coming out. You know, now we seem to have some upper limits of our personal ability to process and to interpret information that is coming to us, but the ways that we can access that can increase in their speed. Google Glasses is something that certainly has got a tremendous amount of potential and people interested in, because it would start to bridge that gap between our wanting to know something and knowing something.
Yeah, you're definitely right. And we can always be connected to the internet. Our memory could be much, much larger. I have a horrible a short-term memory, and I have trouble remembering my students' names, but I'm looking forward to Google Glasses where the glasses would recognize anyone I'm talking to and print out their name in the bottom corner of my glasses, and this would solve one of my mental deficits.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No, I fantasize about that myself, going up and, you know, seeing someone and not only having their name, but, you know, their wife's name and their children's birthdays and the dog. When was the dog purchased? You know, all these things so that you just don't have to scrounge and try to dredge up from our very, very fallible memory.
Yeah, and you could get, what could be even better is if the glasses get good at reading emotions, they could, you know, figure out the person's voice tone and their facial expressions, and the glasses could say, this person is upset with you, or this person is really, you know, wants to get out of the conversation, or they're really interested in what you just said, and they could really improve human-to-human interactions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But of course, you know, at some point, you know, and we're talking about, in the term for it is transhumanism, where we've got this integration, hybrid, you know, computer-human person, which we really already are, as you identified, you know, with all of the ways that we use technology as it stands. You know, at what point does the difference not become important?
Yeah, I don't know if there is a clear dividing line. I mean, you're right. We've already passed some line. I mean, I know I would have died in early childhood if I didn't have advanced medical care.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, the difference for me is being alive and dead, which is pretty large. But yeah, I don't think there is some point in which we'll clearly say we no longer are human anymore. I think we'll just keep, you know, merging with machines and getting smarter and smarter.
Mm-hmm. And that leads, you know, the second half of your book, or the middle third or so, is about the possibility of not an AI singularity, but more of a human singularity. Can you explain that just a little bit?
Sure. Even if we don't get AI, there's lots of ways we can increase human intelligence. For example, I'm currently undergoing something called neurofeedback, where this is any of your listeners could do it as well, where basically I'm staring at a computer screen, and the computer is monitoring my brain waves and causing them to change a little bit and be more flexible to reduce anxiety and help me concentrate more.
Hmm.
Other things, people could do something called the dual endback game that improves your working memory. There are drugs like Adderall that for a lot, not for everyone, but for a lot of people, it can improve concentration.
Mm-hmm.
I think soon we're going to have, it's going to be possible to use genetics to increase your children's intelligence. Right now, we're fairly close to being able to understand the genetic component to intelligence, and we could see these genes will increase intelligence if your kid happens to get them. These genes would retard intelligence. Once you've got that, you could use existing fertility technologies to cause your children to get, you know, a slightly better combination of your genes than they would otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's such tremendously high value to having intelligent children. I mean, just think how much parents spend on private nursery schools.
Yep.
And that I think this technology will be widely embraced by a lot of people.
And you make the point that you know, even without intentional genetic manipulation, this is already kind of occurring. I think it was called Flynn's Law or something along those lines, where, you know, individuals that are of a certain level of intelligence tend to create children who then exceed them in their intelligence in a definable way. And so this is already occurring. We're already getting smarter.
Yeah, you're right. It's called the Flynn effect. It's one of the weirdest phenomenons in social science, where people keep doing better on IQ tests. And this is everywhere throughout the world. And I think one theory is that we're just dealing with more and more information, and our brains are leveling up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we don't know when it's going to... Apparently, the latest research is this is still going, so we still keep getting smarter and smarter. This could actually play a big role in why our economy keeps growing, that we're just getting smarter and better able to deal with all these new technologies.
Which seems so... so anti, you know, what our common experience is, you know, it seems like I look around and I have to deal with more stupid people than ever before. You know, is that true across all segments of society, or is there going to be like an intellectual elite that's going to be arising, you know, and will have the same issues that we're talking about with an ultra AI, but it'll be instead this kind of social and human, you know, ultra person?
Well, with the Flynn effect, it is increasing everyone's intelligence, although it's still keeping a wide gap. And both the very smart and the normally very dumb are getting smarter. Mm-hmm. So there's still this huge gap. I actually think that technologies have a chance of reducing the sort of the cognitive divide. And in some ways, I think they'll be like cell phones, where initially only the rich will get them, but the price is likely to go down. And so we'll have most people using these technologies.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I mean, our government spends so much money on educating poorer people that I suspect that once we had technologies that were proven to increase intelligence, that the governments would widely subsidize them and maybe even in some countries mandate that everyone use them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes some sense. I can see how that would be. You know, and the same thing I think is true with you know, when we talk about a more prosaic type of demographic is lifespan. Lifespan, while, you know, I think a core belief for some people is that, oh, if you're wealthy enough, you can afford any treatment you want and live longer. But when you look at the demographics, it really is a pretty universally increasing number that our length of life, no matter your social status, does increase.
Yeah, you're right. And what's even more interesting is, I mean, the medical care I have available now is probably better than what a billionaire could have gotten 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're likely to see that with different kinds of information technologies, where the really rich will always have access to better stuff now, but the stuff that an average American would have today is better than what a really rich person could have had a decade or so ago.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And hopefully that'll continue on that same path. So there's a lot of things to be worried about with the advent of an ultra AI, or with any of these changes really making dramatic impact upon our lives and how we go. What kind of things can we do to prepare ourselves and to be ready for this this coming change?
Well, one way would be to support organizations like the Singularity Institute. On a sort of more personal level, I think, look, in terms of your job, people will be competing more and more with AIs. Now, eventually they're going to be so good that unless you've merged with machines, you'll be able to do nothing productive for your employer. But along the way, there'll still be a lot of things that you can do that AIs can, and try to focus on getting better at those. For example, one thing I know a lot of parents are having their children learn Mandarin because they figure, you know, there's all these Chinese people, China is growing so quickly, knowing Mandarin will really help. I don't think that's a good investment because computers are getting very good at translating. My suspicion is in 10 years, a computer will be able to better translate from English to Mandarin in reverse than any, you know, native English-speaking human could.
Mm-hmm.
And so learning Mandarin, I think, is something like learning the piano. It's fine, it can maybe develop your brain overall, but it's not a skill you want to teach your kid to make sure they'll be able to earn a living.
Yeah. Yep. And then also too, you know, I think that brings up the idea of the focus on more long-term goals, trying to identify what changes are going to occur, you know, and just be flexible or ready enough maybe to be prepared for them. One thing you mentioned, and we talked about lifespan, one thing you mentioned is that there's a possibility with some of these things occurring that in the next 30, 40 years, certainly within most of our lifespan, it may be that our lifespan will increase infinitely, that we'll reach a singularity for that, and we need to be alive still when that occurs in order to take advantage.
Yeah, no, you're right. This is called, I guess, the live long enough to live forever phenomenon. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you think if you make it to 2045, you can live as long as you want, you really should put a huge amount of effort into making it to 2045. I mean, my studying the singularity has caused me to care a lot more about my diet and exercise and levels of stress.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess that's another type of singularity, is that as our lifespan increases each year, you know, the expected lifespan of individuals, at some point that'll increase faster than 1 year per year. And mm-hmm. at that point, all of a sudden we've broken a limit and we will be able to increase our lifespans to that point.
Yeah, that's a really achieve life longevity escape velocity, where you're right, every year our lifespan goes up by more than a year. And I have this scientist who thinks we'll be able to do this in mice relatively soon, within a decade, which would be interesting. It would show people that, yes, immortality is possible, you know, among people who are currently alive.
Yeah, yeah. So it sounds like, yeah, we need to be prepared. We want to be ready, but we should also be very, very scared.
Yeah.
Of if we don't take some of the right steps. You mentioned the Singularity Institute as being a place that people can support. Where can people find out more about the book Singularity Rising and about Professor Miller?
Sure. The book has a website, singularityrising.com, and I have a website, jamesdmiller.org.
Excellent. Excellent. And I want to say, I apologize. I have to bring us to a close here. We're right up on the end of the show time. But I want to tell people who are listening, the book is absolutely fascinating. It's very approachable. You know, even my son has read it and loved it. And it's not going to scare you so much that you don't want to keep reading. And it's got some very positive messages as well, and really does a great job of explaining where we've been and where we're going and why things are going to change so fast.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, no, thank you. I really appreciate the time and look forward to hopefully speaking with you again soon.
Yes, that would be excellent.
Okay, take care. Take care, Mr. Miller. I appreciate it, and have a great weekend.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. James Miller, Jim Miller, go to jamesdmiller.com or singularityrising.com. Really, I can't speak highly enough of the book. Fascinating. Great conversation. As always, there was like maybe a tenth of what I really wanted to talk about. We got through. There's a tremendous amount more that we could have discussed in that. And you'll want to pick up the book to read more if you're interested in that. It's really good stuff. You know what? We are right. At the end of the day, no time for cool sights of the week this week, but I will grab a little song of the week still. I think we can fit that in anyways. It got cut off last week on the podcast. We wound up not having enough space on the recording. I'm going to leave you right now with, let's see what we've got. You know what I liked today was this kind of neat little song. You know what I'm gonna do instead, since we didn't get the song last week, I'm gonna play it again. Not in Love by Crystal Castles and Robert Smith. You remember him from The Cure. Guess what, he's back. Crystal Castles is the group. Not in Love is a song. Thank you so much for listening to Tech Talk on WRLR LP 98.3 LPFM, Round Lake Heights, Illinois. Stay tuned to the great stuff coming on after us, and make sure you tune back in next week as well. Thanks so much for your time. Talk to you. Have a great week.
I saw your picture hanging on the back of my door.